Matt Marcus.
And I'm Annika Lalik.
This is For All Humankind, a podcast about your place in spaceflight.
This month we'll be interviewing Luke Riesbeck, a space policy analyst with Astroscale US, with a passion for space debris. But before that, we'll be answering some of your questions and discussing the current orbital debris situation and potential options for orbital debris remediation.
Up first is our AMA, Ask Matt and Annika. This episode's questions were all about space debris and property law. So our first question, who owns space?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. Technically, no one. Something we talked about in the last podcast a little bit was the Outer Space Treaty, which has a clause in there regarding sovereign claims to outer space. And the argument there was that no country could go and claim parts of the moon for their own. However, people do own parts of space in terms of the satellites we put up into space. And there are also claims to orbital slots so that you can actually make sure your satellite gets the right geostationary spot that you want it to be in. So the ownership laws aren't really like ownership in the traditional kind of sense that we think of so much as the arrangement for satellites once they're in space. All right, our next question is, what is the policy of space trash? Who has the responsibility of cleaning all that up?
So to start things off, the responsibility of any object that humans have put into space is resting with the launching nation, regardless of who owns the object. According to the Outer Space Treaty, which we talked about a bit on our last episode, it is the responsibility of the launching nation for any liability resulting from an object that they or a company residing within them launched into orbit. There's also what's generally accepted as the 25-year rule, which says that at the end of the life of a spacecraft, you have 25 years to remove it from orbit, or in the case of objects in further out orbits like GEO, to place them into what's known as a graveyard orbit. Of note is this 25-year rule was established decades ago when we were launching, you know, less than 50 satellites a year. And there's that this is sort of a recurring theme with orbital debris these days, that we're starting to launch these mega constellations now of thousands of satellites. And 25 years is probably too much time when we're launching this many satellites in order to keep orbit clean enough that we don't have what's known as an ablation cascade or the Kessler syndrome, where you have sort of a cascading effect where you, once you get a critical mass in orbit, you have two satellites collide and then fragments from that collision hit other satellites and destroy them. And you just have this chain reaction of collisions destroying lots of satellites in orbit, which we definitely don't want. So that's definitely something that people are reevaluating right now, is if that 25-year rule is sufficient, if that needs to be lowered, if that needs to be applied to individual satellites as it has previously been, or maybe if instead it should be applied to an entire constellation.
Yeah, I think viewers might be kind of familiar with Kessler syndrome in the movie WALL-E. If you see the Earth in that movie, it's just like surrounded by this shroud of satellites, which might have resulted from that runaway Kessler syndrome that you mentioned. I also wanted to go back to the responsibility of the launching nation, because I find that to be like the kind of almost frustrating thing about the responsibility of satellites in orbit, because you can have, say, a satellite that was operated by Italy, built by the United States, but launched by France, and France is responsible for the satellite, which seems like maybe not the way we should be doing things.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think there's a lot of rules when it comes to space policy that could really use an update now that the way that we're launching objects into space is in the process of changing so drastically.
Absolutely. And so you mentioned the 25-year rule and deorbiting or putting satellites into a graveyard orbit. The next question that we received was, what are we doing or what should we be doing about these antiquated satellites left in orbit?
So I'll start with what we are doing. We have what's known as space situational awareness, where we have several organizations around the world, such as CSPOC, which is the Combined Space Operations Center, which is a group operated by the Space Force in partnership with other nations that are partnered with the United States in space situational awareness to monitor all objects on orbit and basically run computer algorithms, propagating their orbits forward and finding out if any of them are going to come dangerously close to each other. And then if that does happen, this is what's known as a conjunction assessment, determining if that's because when they do come within a margin of error of each other where there may be a collision, that event is known as a conjunction. So they do all these conjunction assessments, and if there is a conjunction, they notify the operators involved that their satellites may be about to have a collision so that those operators can hopefully maneuver their satellites out of the way.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, because with human spaceflight, I know, you know, the International Space Station has this massively reinforced hull so that it can capture any small space debris. And that kind of makes me want to ask, how big does an object have to be so that we can track it? Is there kind of a limit on that? Or how difficult is this space situational awareness tracking?
Yeah, so the old rule was that anything down to around 10 centimeters, which is around the size of a softball, could be tracked. We are, I think actually now it is online. There's what's known as the new Space Fence, which is basically a big radar installation that the U.S. military operates that can track objects down even smaller. I want to say to around 1 centimeter in size, or that's around the size of a marble.
Wow.
So that answers the question of what are we doing with satellites in orbit right now? Long term, though, you know, if you sort of stopped launching any new objects into orbit right now, which is very much the opposite of what we're doing, you still would have so many objects on orbit that over time they would collide with each other and, albeit somewhat slowly, produce this ablation cascade. So in order to prevent that long term, we really should be removing spent objects from orbit. There's old defunct satellites, and there's also just spent rocket bodies. The, you know, the uppermost stage of a launch vehicle after it gets a satellite into orbit usually ends up in orbit itself. And sometimes if it is expend all of its fuel launching that satellite into orbit, then it is sort of stuck in orbit and stays there until, you know, trace amounts of atmospheric drag bring it down. Which will bring it down in sometime in within a century if it's below around 700 kilometers in orbit, but it takes exponentially longer than that the further up you go as the trace atmosphere drops off very quickly. So a number of different concepts are being looked at to actively remove debris, and these include different strategies depending on if you're removing tiny fragments or large intact objects. We ideally would like to remove certainly the large intact objects with the highest collision probability and highest mass, just because if they're involved in a collision, they generate, you know, hundreds or thousands of these small fragments. So we would like to sort of be proactive and remove these objects before they become those small fragments.
So what you're saying is we want to remove objects that are either really big or in very common orbits or commonly intersecting orbits, right?
That's right. Our next question is, where can people go to study space law, and who is hiring grads?
Great question. So our guest on our previous podcast, Elsbeth, works at the University of Nebraska in the Cyber Telecommunications and Space Law program. So definitely check that out. That is one of the bigger space law programs. George Washington University has a space policy program. And Matt, do you have any other ones off the top of your head that you can think of?
That's definitely the biggest one that comes to mind. I know, like you mentioned, that our previous guest, Elsbeth, is from University of Nebraska. Is that right? Yeah, so that's the other one. Space Policy Institute in D.C. is the biggest one that I can think of. I will reiterate the advice from Elsbeth from our last episode that if you want to go into space law, or really any other field, but focusing on space, it is a totally valid strategy to sort of go and specialize in that field and be very good in that field and then work your way into the space industry. So you can, you know, study in top law programs in the country and then work your way into space law professionally after graduation.
Absolutely. I know the Technology and Policy program at MIT does a lot of work with Harvard Law, so there's some crosstalk there. So again, you can do a conventional law program, and just as long as you have a passion for space, get in that way. Internationally, I know that I think there are some French universities that also focus on space policy and law. I unfortunately do not know those off the top of my head, but I would look into that as well as other places in Europe, because I think they actually do a lot of focus in space law.
Luke Riesbeck is a space policy and research analyst at Astroscale US, where they engage in interdisciplinary collaboration across the space community to find comprehensive solutions to orbital sustainability challenges. A recent graduate of the Space Policy Institute Master's Program at George Washington University, their research interests include space sustainability, orbital debris mitigation, and ethics in space and technology. Riesbeck also holds a bachelor's degree in social science with a minor in global China studies from New York University, Shanghai. In 2018, they were selected as a fellow in the Brooke Owens Fellowship's second annual class. Luke, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
So just to start things off, how did you decide to pursue a career in space policy? And, you know, when did you know growing up that you wanted to work in spaceflight and space policy specifically?
So, yeah, thank you. I kind of, like a lot of people who end up in space policy, had a bit of a roundabout path into the field. So I started at NYU in Shanghai pursuing a social science degree. I knew kind of vaguely that I wanted to do something in the realm of international relations. And I really liked, science and technology, but I didn't think I would pursue a field in it. I wanted something more on the diplomacy side, you know, maybe something in the UN or the State Department or something like that. But then I saw in between the summer of my junior year and my senior year, I saw that there was a NASA internship posting at their Office of International and Interagency Relations at the headquarters in DC. And I was like, wow, that's the perfect intersection of kind of diplomacy and science and technology. So I applied for it and I was lucky enough to get it. It was a really fantastic experience. And from there, I really fell in love with just the space industry and space programs in general. I'd always been a bit of a space nerd on the side and into sci-fi, but never thought I'd be able to actually apply my skill set to the field. So it's been really, really great. I mean, that NASA internship really connected me to a lot of different opportunities. So I'm always grateful for that.
That's awesome. What was that like studying in Shanghai and kind of getting that international experience on top of your education?
It was really fun. Yeah, it was, by the time I went in, there was actually only one class above mine. So the inaugural class was the class that graduated the year before ours. So it was a really new program. And I think they were really looking for students from different backgrounds who usually don't get out of their hometowns. That was certainly the case for me growing up in rural Ohio. Never thought I would leave the country for my undergrad degree, but I was really lucky enough to get a spot in that class and also get a great financial aid package. So that really sealed the deal for me. China was a great experience. I think it definitely opened my eyes to just the value of getting as many different perspectives as you can in a room when you talk about any kind of concept, from social science concepts and sociology issues to you know, science and technology, mathematics issues as well.
Anything interesting that you picked up on particularly differences in, you know, perspectives of space programs and space policies between the US and China?
Yeah, after I got back from my NASA internship, I ended up doing my senior thesis for undergrad on the sort of development of China's national space program. And that was, I think, really interesting because it's, I think growing up as an American, you really only do hear about American space ventures. I barely knew about other space agencies at all, and especially not ones that aren't just Russia, you know, Roscosmos, ESA, NASA. So it really opened my eyes. And it also kind of was a crash course for myself in what are some of the big issues in space policy that will be important in my lifetime. And I think US-China relations in space, from human spaceflight to, you know, sharing space science data, that's a huge, it's going to be a huge element of like the geopolitical space landscape.
Yeah, definitely. In kind of the Artemis generation too, coming up, we'll see a lot of that. You mentioned kind of the big space policy kind of problems or things, well, challenges we'll be facing in the next few years. And something that we've talked about on the podcast has been space debris. And so my next question is, how bad is the current orbital debris situation? You know, we've heard that space is really big and that's always kind of drilled into us. But at the same time, we've also heard these sensationalized debris scenarios and kind of seen the movie Gravity where, you know, we have all these issues come up. So what is the rundown and what are the kind of policy issues surrounding that?
So I'm glad you mentioned Gravity because it's a great action flick. It is a little sensationalized. That film depicts absolute worst case scenario, which is, you know, two astronauts actively engaged in a EVA are faced with a Kessler syndrome that erupts so quickly that they don't even have time to get back in their station. It's pretty implausible. I mean, we are able to track conjunctions a couple of days in advance in most cases, so it wouldn't be that quite that dramatic. But hey, it's a movie and it's pretty entertaining. So I think I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, as somebody who's actually trying to mitigate the risks of space debris for everybody, not just for you know, government space programs. It's kind of a blessing and a curse to have, you know, media stories that are a bit sensationalized like that. But, you know, space is big. I mean, there's definitely truth to that. But when you're talking about orbital debris, you're not really talking about the entire vast void of all of space. You're talking about very specific, you know, regions of Earth orbit. So the risk posed by debris, you know, is different in those different areas. Debris can range in size. It can be all the way, you know, less than a millimeter in across, all the way to these, you know, huge things like spent rocket stages and things like that. So unfortunately, the majority of space debris is so small that it's still difficult for us to track. It's, you know, that less than 1 centimeter size. And that's about 128 million pieces right now. And that's rising because the big pieces eventually break apart and turn into littler pieces, you know, and those pieces seem really small, but they can still cause a lot of damage to satellites. There's about 900,000 objects in that sort of medium range, which is between 1 centimeter and 10 centimeters in size. And then everything above 10 centimeters in size is about 34,000 objects right now. So all told, there's a lot up there. The debris that's at lower altitudes will naturally decay over time. But some of those larger pieces in the higher orbits could take, you know, 2,000 years or more to naturally decay. So obviously we have to find a different solution for those. So, I mean, the work that I do at Astroscale US is we have, you know, a combined approach. You know, we don't think that just having a technical solution to remove certain pieces of debris is enough. To actually make a difference, you have to kind of address the problem from a sort of prevention and a cure together kind of a standpoint. So, you know, we advocate for mitigation measures, things like, you know, measuring risk in a more comprehensive way and investing in better space situational awareness sensors to get a better map, a better picture of what's actually up there. And then we also, you know, advocate on the cure side, on the remediation side, for, you know, the technology, the policy, and the business approaches to removing that debris that's up there and disposing of satellites at the end of their life. So we try to have a comprehensive view, a comprehensive approach, rather than just focusing on ADR technology.
And how do you assess the risk of these, you know, different objects? And I know there's sort of some rules right now for how we address risk. So sort of what are we doing now? And I feel like the space industry is in the process of changing in a quite significant way with, you know, like these mega constellations that SpaceX and others are launching now. Full disclosure, I've previously done some orbital debris research from the engineering side. But but yeah, sort of how do we address that risk right now? And how does that need to change as the way we're operating in space changes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. A starting point is just to acknowledge what you just said, that as the way we operate in space changes, we do need to change the way that we measure and the way we limit, you know, the risk on orbit. If we want to keep space safe and sustainable for long-term use, you know, not just our children, but our grandchildren and their grandchildren, you know, it's important to start these things now rather than wait until something gets so bad that, you know, it's all reactive action instead of being proactive, right? So that in and of itself, you know, saying that we need to make sure we're adapting with the times is surprisingly can sometimes face some roadblocks. So you know, there are a couple of things that we specifically have advocated for on the U.S. side. Right now, this is a question that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which licenses commercial satellites, is considering. There was a orbital debris mitigation standard practices from the from NASA, a whole of USG, but you know, delivered through NASA, that also was recently updated. And you know, right now, like this is a debate. It's an ongoing debate on what can we do, what are some best practices, and for us, you know, there are a couple of key items that we think are, you know, most influential and have the greatest ability to really get at the problem. One of them is, you know, today, if you're a U.S. satellite operator, you're applying for a license to operate in the U.S. If you have an application for a constellation, for a mega constellation or a smaller constellation, the risk of your satellites is essentially the risk. It's presented to the FCC, the risk of one satellite in that system, and that satellite is that whatever that number is essentially just ascribed to the entire constellation. I mean, that's simplifying things, but at a basic level, that's essentially what happens. And you know, we just don't agree with that. We think that the smartest way to measure risk is in the aggregate, adding together everything you're putting up and including all the factors of how it's designed, its internal reliability, you know, its projected life, you know, failure rates of your constellation, and also how you operate it, right? What your internal decision tree is as a company for how you react to certain situations. All of those things we think should go into that risk equation. And, you know, a big part of that is that risk equation does include the variable of how many satellites you actually have operating at one time. And it's, you know, I think that there might be a conception that, you know, in order to really stop the spread of space debris and the creation of more debris, that we can't have mega constellations at all. I don't think that's true. I think that there is absolutely a safe way to do it. We just need to be more honest about the math and be more frank and upfront about it. And once we do that, you know, we can design a more communicative, a more back and forth robust system between, you know, operators and regulators to, you know, keep each other informed of risk as it's changes to risk as it happens, you know, throughout the deployment of a full constellation and over the different waves of replenishing those constellations, you know, because failures do happen. I mean, it would be silly to expect any satellite operator of that many satellites to never have a failure ever. I mean, that's just not practical. But you know, that doesn't mean that we can't, you know, be communicating more about it. And yeah, things happen, but it's the lack of communication and the lack of a system that encourages operators to be, you know, upfront and in constant communication about that risk that's creating more risk. And, you know, ultimately more risk means everybody's limited in what they can do. And we're all limited in how long we can do it until it's just, not safe at all. That sounds a little dire, but that's just how we see it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the risk of space debris is definitely something that could easily become dire, right? As we, you know, if we don't curtail it now, kind of on the development side.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those problems where sometimes it's the urgency of the situation is only apparent after something bad happens. I mean, we saw that with a lot of other industries that operate in, you know, these extreme environments, right? If you look at the nuclear industry, or you look at, you know, oil and gas, it's only after these sort of disaster events that you get stringent regulation to mitigate risk, right? And I mean, we don't have that sort of direct tie to, you know, risk to human life that, you know, those other industries do on the ground. But, you know, risk to satellites is risk to human society, right? I think it's more, there's kind of more information than ever out there about just how much space data is incorporated into our everyday lives. So yeah, it's more of a quality of life and, you know, longevity of what we're trying to do in space as an industry question.
Absolutely. And I mean, I guess kind of transitioning a little bit, I know it's one thing to regulate all of the US companies and to kind of control what's happening within a single country. But, you know, over the last, you know, decade, we've seen a lot of international players enter space. And could you maybe describe the challenges of making international space policy, whether it be for, I guess we can focus on orbital debris, but just like, how does that process work for people who may not have ever thought about that before? And what are the unique challenges of trying to agree on something with, you know, a global scale thing like space?
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, space is sometimes called the sort of tragedy of the commons when it comes to space debris, right? That everybody wants to operate as much as they can without really being too proactive about mitigating that risk that they're posing. But actually, you know, I think that the last decade has seen some huge leaps forward in international cooperation on space sustainability and space safety in general. You know, there's sort of a realization that commercial space is kind of here to stay, and it's not just a wave. And that's great, right? That means so many more people can do really, really cool science and really, really cool, you know, provide really cool services from space. But it also means that each of these, you know, international governments who have their, you know, they have a responsibility to oversee all the commercial activity within their nation that's licensed through their nation. That means they have a lot more to consider. And I mean, there are existing forums, you know, the IADC is a big one where all the major space agencies are, you know, cooperating on debris mitigation work. And then the other big one is the UN COPUS. They have the UN's Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. They have a working group that has worked for, you know, more than a decade now on the creation of long-term sustainability guidelines. And just a couple years ago, they released a first initial set of 21 guidelines. And this was a huge milestone for the space sustainability, you know, global effort. You know, you got a ton of these member states to actually agree to 21 principles that they said, okay, we're going to take these ideas and we're going to go implement them into our domestic, you know, regulations and licensing, you know, regimes. That sounds like a very, you know, sort of basic foundational step, but it took 9 years for them to agree to that, to get consensus on those 21 guidelines. And it's a great starting point. Yeah, there's, you know, international space policy is just like any other kind of international policy. You know, it can take a long time to agree, but I think space is really interesting right now because it's so much more with the proliferation of commercial space activities. There's just so much more for these governments to consider that, you know, they have to find different ways of convening and agreeing with each other on them. I will say too, I mean, we've seen a total explosion in new space agencies, in what I kind of call like emerging space nations, which is really exciting. I think, you know, as long as the sort of legacy space community and the legacy, you know, space nations who, you know, have all this heritage and all this experience, as long as they're, you know, sharing information and you know, being good mentors to these younger nations, I shouldn't say younger, it's these more less experienced in space nations, there's some great collaboration to be had, because these new space nations, they can specialize so much more, right? They don't have to start from scratch like the other ones did. So they can leverage the talents they already have within their economies and apply them to space. And, you know, sometimes that can result in some really cool benefits for their domestic economies and their people. So it's a really fun time. Yeah.
Absolutely. As a Canadian, that really makes me laugh, because we kind of put everything on the Canada arm. We just went all in on one robotic arm. So we really specialize.
Yeah. Canada arm. That's great. No, I mean, space robotics is like my favorite thing.
That's Matt's thing too.
If you're going to do one thing, have it be that, right? Plus you guys are going to have an astronaut go up soon.
Yeah. That was really exciting when that happens. We really.
Yeah. On commercial crew, really tried, right?
To, yeah.
That's going to be great.
Yeah. I'm excited.
Yeah.
You know, I know in the U.S., there's definitely seems to be a lot of roadblocks to international collaboration, especially with the ITAR. You know, does the ITAR need to change? And how do we write future space policy to encourage this international collaboration while still making sure that all of the countries are comfortable that their intellectual property in space is protected?
That's a big one. That is a big one. Yeah, so a lot of this has specifically to do with the space workforce in the U.S. There are still barriers because of the export control regime that we currently have for space. There are some barriers as to, you know, who is able to pursue a career in space, both at commercial and governmental space, you know, organizations. And I think, I don't really know if I can say that it's something that should be changed, because, you know, space technologies are definitely, you know, so many of them have been shifted over from that highly controlled list. But they're still, you know, I mean, you're talking about launch vehicles. That's still pretty dangerous stuff. I mean, my opinion is that international talent is really important to have here, especially because we educate a lot of international talent in space, you know, disciplines, and then we make it really difficult for them to actually work here. I don't think that makes much sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But maybe if there was like some way that we could, you know, you could limit the export of information to external agencies, but somehow still, you know, allow an international workforce in your own agencies, which is a non-trivial problem for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, you know, the U.S. government definitely does engage a lot with international space agencies, at least through, you know, through my perspective. One of the ways that they go about doing that is they have these sort of no exchange of fund, you know, cooperative missions, right? Where each partner will supply, you know, their own expertise, their own hardware, their own, you know, mission design elements, and personnel. And it's just a pure collaboration without any exchange of funds or official contracting, right? Which helps make things a little bit easier on the governmental side, but yeah, it's still a tough issue. I will say that it's on the minds of regulators who are, you know, addressing and overseeing space issues. So I think we're likely to see some movement on it in the next couple of years with this new administration. But still a ways to go.
Yeah, and I guess just like as a another kind of follow-on question to like what you're just saying about the new administration. You know, I'm sure they're trying to formulate their space policy right now. So can you talk about, like, are there any changes that you would suggest that they make, or any new policies that you think they should pursue? If that's not, you know, I don't want you to like jump the gun or anything. If you have to wait for like official policies or anything, but if there's anything you can say regarding that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, at least on our side at Astroscale US, I mean, we really think that, the time is ripe for, you know, the U.S. government in general, to really consider commercial satellite servicing in a big way. That's still one area of U.S. space policy that's still a little less robust than others. It's one of those things that we think is really key to that long-term sustainability. Right now, you know, the entire space industry, you know, operates essentially without mechanics, without doctors in space that can go up and you know, inspect or, you know, repair or refuel a satellite that's run out of fuel, or move it out of harm's way if it has a, you know, a failure on orbit, anything like that. I mean, we were driving on a bunch of roads without any AAA, you know. And so in our opinion, that's got to be a priority for the new administration. But that's sort of one subset of a larger focus on space safety and space sustainability that has been underway, you know, through the last few years of the Trump administration and into this new one. One of the big questions is whether the sort of mission, the U.S. mission of space traffic management, will end up being housed under the Department of Commerce or the Department of Transportation. In the Obama White House, you know, they were advocating for it to be, you know, in the Department of Transportation. But in the past couple of years, there have been several studies and some initial funding granted to the Department of Commerce to organize a space traffic management system. Regardless of where it falls, I mean, that is huge because, you know, more and more satellites are going up, and having sort of a central repository, an open source repository, where all those different actors can submit their, you know, their ephemeris, their position data, essentially, of where they are and where they're going, and, you know, coordinate with the Space Force's database for conjunction alerts, you know, that's really sorely needed. That is a basic space safety element that the U.S. has led in for a long time. And to maintain that leadership, we really have to focus on that. So in general, I think, you know, we're still really early on. we're still in first 100 days territory for the Biden administration. This is going to be a very busy first 4 years of this administration when it comes to space. There's a lot that was left on the table, a lot to work out. So obviously our focus is on sort of the space safety and sustainability elements, but I mean, there's a lot there. You know, I mean, we could have our Artemis plans really, really solidified in these next few years. That's super exciting. A lot to address there.
Completely agreed. Just to back up a little bit for listeners who might not be as familiar with the term sustainability as it pertains to orbits into space, could you just like define sustainability in a space context? Because I think people think of, you know, reusing plastic bags or, you know, recycling and that kind of sustainability on a consumer level. But in space, it's equally as important in terms of, you know, keeping our resources sustainable and keeping our presence in space sustainable. So if you could like speak to that and define it, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, that's a great foundational question. I feel like I should have done that first. yeah, so big picture, the environment of Earth orbit is really crowded right now, and it's really dangerous to operate in. And it's only going to get more congested in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. there's been a lot more types of people in space, a lot of different types of actors and different nations joining space activities, which is really good. But there's been a sort of reckoning that we need to readdress and rethink the way that we operate to ensure that space operations are safe enough that they don't create so much orbital debris and so much congestion that nobody can operate safely for future in future generations, right? And in the short term and in the long term. So a space sustainability mission, I think in general, includes those three things I mentioned before, the technologies, the policies, and the business approaches to, you know, standardize the operational practices for safety, to better characterize the orbital environment, and to advocate and adopt sort of responsible best practices, responsible behavior for all different types of space actors so that the environment itself is as safe and easy to operate in as possible. So that's how I would define space sustainability. There's a lot of different disciplines and a lot of different, you know, issues within space sustainability, but it's essentially securing a space environment that we can operate, that as many people can operate in for as long as possible. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great description.
And to achieve space sustainability, let's say we were to, you know, sort of responsibly deorbit anything new that we launch as we rapidly accelerate the number of satellites we're putting into orbit. Is that enough to ensure space sustainability, or do we need to, you know, sort of actively change the existing situation with debris that's already on orbit in addition to best practices going forward?
Yeah, so I think that there's a prevention and a cure, you know, element to this conversation, right? So, I mean, we think that, you know, there are practices that each operator can implement that are those sort of preventative measures, those mitigation measures on the front end. And that's through, you know, all the way from the design phase, like the initial idea of your satellite, through operation, through your pre-launch and launch, you know, while you're on orbit and as the satellite reaches its end of life and you know, deorbits. There's steps in each and every one of those stages of the lifetime of a spacecraft that operators can take to reduce the risk of what their satellite poses in space.
Like, is there kind of a 10 commandments of best practices or something? Like, these are the actions. I don't know, maybe it's not 10, but is there like some reasonably short list of things we can do to sort of mitigate the debris situation?
Thinking something like reduce, reuse, recycle, but for space.
Yeah, I know. It's you know, I wish that there was a standard kind of cookie cutter top things that everyone could do. But you know, the biggest risk right now is to the, you know, LEO satellite operators, right? The non-geostationary satellite operators.
These are all everything that's. So this is like everything that's closest to the Earth. We're like in the just above the atmosphere, and as opposed to most communication satellites, which are thousands and thousands of miles away from the surface, these are the objects that are going around really fast in basically every direction, where you can kind of have a head-on collision at, you know, something like 10 kilometers per second.
It's also where the people are.
That's true. Yeah.
I think that a couple of basic things that space operators in sort of the non-geostationary space operators can do is, for one thing, be maneuverable. Have propulsion on your satellite or other techniques, you know, things like space tugs and drag sails and things like that. Something that allows you to avoid collision while you're on orbit. That's a very basic one that you can do. And I guess another one would be consider sharing your data to the maximum extent that you can as a business. Sharing, you know, your ephemeris, sharing your positional data, your maneuver plans with the operators who are kind of in your orbital neighborhood is a really, really great way to keep everybody around you safe, right? Because if something does go wrong, they have the point of contact of who do I call to figure this situation out, right? Another one is, you know, a lot of operators in low Earth orbit, they think that just because they're in that low Earth orbit region and their satellite at end of life will naturally sort of passively decay over the course of 25 years, which is the current guidance for US operators, at least, because it will sort of decay naturally within that 25 years, that they think they don't really need to have a disposal plan, a backup deorbit plan. That even if their satellite fails, because it will naturally decay within that time frame, they're good. And I mean, that's just not good enough anymore for the modern, you know, LEO environment. So I would plan for direct reentry as soon as the mission is complete. And if you can't do that, then have some sort of backup plan to deorbit at least to under 400 kilometers as quickly as you can. Yeah, it's sort of like we need to, as a community, adopt more of a leave no trace kind of mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that analogy.
So I did all of my PhD research on like active debris removal technologies. And basically, something that I learned is this is a problem that is basically solved, or in the next 5 years will be solved from an engineering perspective. You know, I've worked on OSAM-1, which is an on-orbit satellite servicing mission that we'll be launching in the next couple of years. And once we do that, we will have proven that we can capture a satellite that was not originally meant to be captured and move it and do more complex operations with it, which is enough to go out and remove debris just with that technology. So I think it is close to being solved from an engineering perspective.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's already there for sure.
So what do we... You know, what do we do from a policy perspective so that, you know, someone just goes ahead and does it?
At the very, very end of the last few days of the Trump administration, the Office of Science and Technology Policy released a report about a national ADR and a little bit of on-orbit servicing, but mostly ADR strategy. That's something that, you know, You're absolutely right. The engineering is there. The technical solutions are there. It's just a question of ensuring effective oversight, adoption on the U.S. side, on the government side, of standard commercial interfaces. So that way, companies can actually bid on contracts to do this kind of work. And then from there, developing a licensing regime for commercial on-orbit services that is robust enough to where these companies have the security and the stability of knowing that they'll be able to be licensed, you know, in time to do these types of missions and to essentially just jumpstart this entire new sector of the industry. It's the exact type of problem that we're working on now. and areas like, you know, debris mitigation regulations at the FCC, that's a big part of it. But, you know, you're right in that there is no one central agency that is the ADR and or on-orbit servicing hub from a regulatory standpoint. If you haven't read that report, I really encourage you to check it out. I can send you a copy because it had some really interesting ideas. And I know on the NASA side, you know, they just recently started up a national OSAM initiative to get feedback from industry on how can we help you commercialize this technology and actually make it into, you know, a market. And I mean, Astroscale is launching our first ADR demo next month, which we're really excited for. That's out of Baikonur on the Astroscale Japan side. And here in the US, you know, we're working in the on-orbit servicing kind of side of things primarily. We're really, really active on Capitol Hill right now, really trying to get this going. So
do you have any advice for students who are trying to decide what area of space or engineering they want to go into, or who might want to study policy and maybe find themselves in a similar position to to how you entered the field, kind of thinking they wanted to do diplomacy and getting involved through that avenue.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, if they're listening to this podcast, then they're already in a great place, I would say. I think the biggest thing is there are a lot of, you know, peers and young professionals out there right now who are really just, you know, diving in headfirst into space. And so I think getting that peer mentorship as a first entry is huge. If you know somebody who is majoring in a space-related field or who is, you know, maybe in an arts or graphic design or a, you know, journalism degree, but wants to cover space and wants to, you know, contribute to the space industry, get to know them, see who their network is, connect with, you know, people that they see. And then, you know, another thing I tell anyone who wants to get involved in space is just start reading space-related news. It seems so basic, but it'll really catch you up on, like, who are prominent figures in the space industry and who's working on the types of problems that you want to contribute to. If satellite broadband is what makes you excited, go look up who's doing that. and just, you know, it sounds really basic, but I think a lot of the space industry is still extremely welcoming and extremely ready to have a virtual coffee and give you some advice about how you can get started. So in addition to sort of finding people and following news, I would say that, you know, getting to know those peer mentors is a really foundational step. I think that, again, you know, even though I sort of had a roundabout way of getting here, you don't have to start at something like a NASA internship to get into space. you can start in a whole lot of different ways. And there's room for every single discipline in the space industry. You don't have to be an engineer. You don't have to be a physicist. You don't have to be... Everybody's skills are definitely needed in this industry because it's really rapidly expanding. We need artists. We need archivists and data scientists and everything. I guess that's kind of the theme of your podcast, right? It's for all humankind. I couldn't agree more with that. it's true, though. I mean, it's become a bit of a mantra now among the... Especially young space professionals, like... It's space right now is really opening up for all different types of disciplines. So I would say biggest piece of advice is start at the peer mentorship level and then see what their network is and follow some cool space news and, you know, you'll be in no time.
For All Humankind is an independent podcast produced in collaboration with the Women of Aeronautics and Astronautics, or WOA. It is hosted by Matt Marcus and Annika Rolick. Sound design, editing, and original music is by Mitchell Marcus.
Our guest today was Luke Riesbeck, a space policy analyst at Astroscale US. You can follow them on Twitter at Luke Riesbeck, which will be linked in the description.
Have a question you want us to answer? Suggestions for someone to interview or a specific subject to cover? General comments about the show? Let us know at forallhumankindpod@gmail.com. One word, all lowercase. You can find us at For All Humankind Pod on Facebook and Instagram, at All Humankind Pod on Twitter, or visit our website, forallhumankind.org. Thanks.